Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
If you're set to go, Toby's got the keys.
Motor Talk with Toby Hagen.
Toby, evening.
Good evening, Phil.
How are you? Coming through loud and clear from out in the garage. I'm up in the living room, of course.
Indeed.
That's the way everyone's working these days, you know, Toby. I mean, someone said the other day, why is everyone sounding like they're at the bottom of a well? I said, well, look, you know what? We're doing the magic of radio, but what Toby and I would normally be, you know, sitting around here on the mechanics creeper together, but not so.
That's right. I'm spending more time in my office and more time at home than I think I have for many, many years. So it's certainly a change of pace.
Yeah, no, exactly right. I think that's it's the same for everyone, isn't it, Toby? Car industry, of course, is feeling the pain from all of this big time. I expect the fallout from this is going to affect the motor vehicle industry. You wonder whether some makes might survive here, Toby. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think it'll put enormous pressure on some brands and some, you know, you look at the industry generally and the margins in the car industry aren't enormous. So, you know, if they're making 6, 8, 10%, that's usually a pretty good margin on a car. So yep. The minute you rip so many sales out of the equation and you have to do things like shutting down a factory, that can have massive implications on the profitability or otherwise of a company. So very, very challenging times. And you look at some of the brands that I think might tend to struggle, and things like Alfa Romeo, for example, which was already struggling, trying to muscle back into that luxury car space, and all of a sudden they've got this coming into the equation. In Australia, I wouldn't be surprised if some brands decide to pack up and think it's all too tough. And, you know, some of the brands that are already, I guess, on the fringe in Australia in terms of how many cars they're selling, brands like Fiat and Chrysler, which are already very, very small in terms of sales.
Yep.
Peugeot, Citroën, Renault, all three of the French brands don't have massive sales in Australia and at various times have bailed out of Australia. Although that said, Citroën is the longest continuously running brand that's been on sale in Australia, so it would be a shame if they packed up. But yeah, it's tough times.
Yeah. I mean, we've been talking, you've been talking to us now for a few years about the almost 2 years of continuous declines in new car sales. I mean, from what you're chatting about to people, I mean, some people are talking about a 50% decline as a result.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, these are discussions I had, some of them last week, some of them early this week. And obviously we see how much is changing day by day and how various restrictions are changing the way we live our lives. So that may well have changed. But yeah, look, the feeling I got was most brands sort of felt that over the next few months, before the end of the financial year, they seem to think between a 30 and 50% drop in sales. So that's an enormous drop off to where we are. And you mentioned, obviously, that we have seen almost 2 years of continual sales drops. And I think February was down about 8.2%. I think the industry would do anything they could to get back to an 8% drop in sales because it's just enormous in terms of what's happening now. So the challenge for the car makers, obviously, is adjusting their order intakes at the moment. And they work many months in advance in terms of orders. And in terms of planning, they work many years in advance. So the orders, for example, they're all on the boats already. They're coming here. There are going to be plenty of boats rolling up with cars on the expectation that they were going to sell in the numbers that they forecast. Obviously, as we said, that's changed. It's going to be very much lower. So there will be an initial glut of cars. There's certainly going to be plenty of cars kicking around initially. But that said, they're adjusting their orders from now, saying, please stop sending them because they need to adjust to demand.
And, do they do with them all, Toby? I mean, you can't leave them outside in the yard forever, can you?
So there's big holding yards in the main capital cities. There's companies that do just this. So they hold the cars, but it costs them money to keep the cars there. So the term is they're sitting on grass, and that's in a lot of cases, that's what they're doing. Places like Melbourne, for example, anyone who drives between Melbourne and Geelong regularly, you'll often see the big yards down there, and they've got the hail nets above them in case the hail opens up. So those will be pretty full, I'd imagine, over the next few months. But look, they just have to start trying to work out how they're going to sell them. And, and typically deals come into the equation and obviously discounting. But I think you'll start to see obviously some pencils sharpened over the next few months. But you'll also see them start trying to, I guess, value add in terms of additional warranties or maybe some servicing thrown in. Car makers hate doing the just a straight discount because it does negatively impact resale values. So if someone bought that same car 2 months ago and all of a sudden you're selling it for $5,000 less, then it can have a pretty bad effect on resale values. Whereas if they tend to throw other things into the equation, be it servicing or extra features or whatever it might be, that has much less of an impact on resale values. So you'll see a few of those games going on, and it's all going to depend on the different brands and how much they've got kicking around.
Okay, but I mean, don't expect to be suddenly getting massive discounts off cars.
No, you're not going to be getting 30-40% or anything like that. And look, at the end of the day, they're going to do what I guess as little as they can to try and shift the cars. And as I said, they will be turning off the taps now in terms of what's coming into the country. So, I mean, you know, that's going to take a few months to, or at least a couple of months to flow through. But they'll absolutely be adjusting on that front to then try and say, well, how do we, and then try and, I guess, clear the cars going forward. The challenge for the car makers here is working out, I guess, when consumer confidence returns and when we start to go back to some sort of normality, because they then want to make sure they've got enough cars there for the imminent demand that probably will kick in. Now, it's obviously not going to kick into the levels we were at, but it'll start ramping up at some point. And the brands that are ready for that and have those cars there, they're the ones that are going to benefit at that point. But, I mean, far out, it's a difficult game to play, isn't it? No one knows what's going on. No one can accurately predict what's going on and when we will get back to normality. So it's a massive challenge. I'd hate to be a sales manager or a product planner in a car maker at the moment.
Exactly right. I had a couple of texts saying Honda's about to pull out of Australia. They're going to change the way they sell cars in Australia. Are they necessarily pulling out? I think we've found Toby back again. Hi, Tobe.
Hello, I'm back with you. The technology's working again.
It's working again, exactly. Sorry, we just stabbed at the dash and got whatever song. I thought it was Jack Johnson. Wasn't either. So, yeah. Anyway, just back on that question about Honda. They are going to change the way they sell cars. They're not necessarily pulling out, are they?
No, well, let's say they're not pulling out at the moment. There are some of the dealers who I think are sceptical, and there's obviously a lot of dealers who are unhappy at the moment. But look, Honda's put out a statement saying that they will change the way they do business as of mid next year. Mm-hmm. So they're still continuing as they are for the moment. But yeah, they're going to go to what they call an agency model. So instead of having dealers, I guess, fighting for business, and you can go and shop the same car between those dealers, it's going to be a fixed price model. So basically, that's the price of the car. You can check it out online first, and then they've got these dealers as agents around the country that then you go and pick the car up from. So there's some benefits to that in terms of at the moment when you go to a dealer and you say, you know, I want that car in red, for example, and they say, well, we haven't got a red one, we've only got a black one. We could potentially do a swap with the dealer up the road. So that's when it gets a bit frustrating. Under this model, they're going to say that Honda keeps all the cars in their inventory, and you then say, I want the red one, and they say, no problems, we've got three red ones, we'll have it up to you in a week. So it's so from that perspective, I guess it's okay, but you're not going to be able to get deals. It will be, as I said, that's the price and no haggling. And there's going to be fewer dealerships. Now, they haven't said how many fewer dealerships, but there's a few people in the industry that seem to think three in Sydney, for example. So that's a massive change from where they are. They've got now, I think, 106 dealerships around the country. Mm-hmm. So obviously a bulk of those in Sydney, and reducing that to three is going to be very much fewer than they had previously.
Yeah, exactly. You know how we were talking about the luxury car tax and pushes on to scrap that. I mean, there's not a lot of rationale for the luxury car tax anymore, given we don't make cars here, and it's basically just a tax because the government can. And
yeah, that's right. And $600 plus million a year it brings them in, and as you say, very little rationale considering there's no luxury tax on any other item in the country.
No.
So the car makers obviously don't like it at all. They've been lobbying for years to try and get rid of it. They started to ramp that lobbying up about 2 or 3 weeks ago, particularly when Holden said they were shutting up shop. But that has obviously fallen very much on the back burner, I would have thought. I don't think the government will be thinking about that for a very long time. So that'll, I guess, end up on the agenda again in another 6 or 12 months.
Yes, and are the New South Wales Police keeping an eye on the public purse? They seem to have been intoxicated by the idea of a big American truck as well.
Oh, this is unbelievable. I mean, this is the New South Wales Police already spend more on their highway patrol cars than anyone else, up to $120,000 plus BMWs they've been splashing out on, when the rest of the nation seems to make do with cars with about worth about half that much. And their latest spend is a Ram 1500, so the massive Dodge Ram trucks that they've splashed almost $100,000 on.
What do they need that for?
Well, look, this is the Marine Area Command, so it's the water police, I guess, and they're saying they need it to tow jet skis around, which, look, there's plenty of vehicles that will do that job absolutely fine.
A Toyota would do that. I mean, for
Toyota Hiace, Ford Ranger, Mitsubishi Triton, all of which can tow up to 3.5 tonnes.
Yeah.
They're saying the advantage of this is it can tow up to 4.5 tonnes, but once you've got that 4.5 tonnes in the back of this car, in the back of a Ram, it actually reduces the load capacity of the vehicle. So how many the weight of people, equipment and luggage and so on in the tray, it reduces that capacity to 117 kilograms. Now, they've already got, apparently they've got some boxes in the back to carry their guns and other equipment. And then, you know, so that'd be, let's call it at least 10, 20, 30 kilos for that. So it's going to have to be a pretty light policeman to get in there to get in under that limit.
Exactly.
And the other thing is, obviously these use a huge amount of fuel. It's got a 5.7-litre V8 engine, petrol engine, whereas the vast majority of towing these days is done with diesel engines. So it uses about double the fuel of any of those other utes. And it also lacks key safety equipment. So it does, if it were tested for NCAP, the NCAP safety ratings, it would not get a 5-star rating today because it doesn't have autonomous emergency braking, for example. Now, that's something the New South Wales government and all state governments around the country these days say that cars should be a 5-star rating. But the police in New South Wales get an exemption to it because they're saying in some cases we need some different vehicles. So so they managed to dodge that one. But I just think the price of these in the current environment, the amount that that the hundreds of billions that the country is splashing out on trying to keep the economy vaguely ticking over, and all of a sudden they're spending money on vehicles like this, it just seems crazy.
Not really reading the room, I agree. Dave from Northmead's just kicked us off with a car joke. It's a sort of an insider Citroën joke. Toby, my friend just got a job at Citroën. He had to send in two CVs.
Yeah.
Boom, boom. Thank you, Dave.
The old CV.
That's a very good one, Dave. Not your best work, Dave, but it's not bad. It's not bad. Let's take some calls. Ken, you're first up. Hi. G'day, Ken.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Yeah. Gentlemen, I'm 6'4.5" and I'm struggling to get into cars other than stepping up. I've had 100 series in the past. I've had Jaguars and I've had, nice cars. I'm thinking forward, excuse my croakiness, but where do I go from here? I don't want to pull myself out of a low riding car sedan, which is a favorite drive for me, but I'm looking that I have to go up to these 4x4s to step into them. And at my size, what is it? Is there a saloon out there made for me not to pull myself out of them, as my knee height is higher than the step out?
Yeah, look, obviously, part of the problem. What's your rough budget, incidentally? Where are you roughly looking at price?
Well, that's unlimited.
Unlimited. Wow, now we're talking.
I've stepped in and out of Bentleys and Rolls Royces and so forth, yeah. And I don't mean that to be shocking, but yes, they're a great drive, but they're not an everyday drive.
No, absolutely. Look, in terms of, I guess, that being lower to the road, the vast majority of sedans these days obviously keep you a fair bit lower, and that's why so many people, like the higher ride height of the SUVs. The one thing, you said you came out of a 100 series Land Cruiser, which was obviously very good off-road, pretty, particularly by today's standards, fairly agricultural in terms of its on-road dynamics. And the SUVs that you get into these days have stepped up enormously, and you're getting some really tricky technology in terms of how they control things like body roll. So, for example, these active stabilizer bars, so that when you turn into a corner, it actually stiffens the stabilizer bar to stop the car leaning. And with some of them, you almost get no lean at all. It basically sits almost entirely flat as you tip into a corner. So you can get very much or very close to passenger car ride and dynamics out of some of these SUVs compared with some of the typical sedans. And one I actually drove the other day, which I'm thinking off the top may potentially suit you in that regard is the latest GLE Mercedes-Benz. So it's the standard GLE is nothing special, but the one I drove had this active airmatic suspension that it actually not only has those stabilizer bars to keep the thing steadier, but it's also got individual height adjustment on each of the air suspension systems. And what it can do is you tip into a corner, it actually dips almost instantaneously dips the inside wheels so that it effectively tilts into a corner a bit like a motorbike. And you can really feel it sort of tilting in as it goes around. So that's just an example of some of the technology going around. I mentioned Mercedes-Benz because I find I'm also quite tall, and I find Mercedes-Benzes generally have quite a bit of room compared with a lot of other cars. Maybe it's the stature over in Germany. They tend to give me a fair bit of leg room, and it's one of the few cars that I don't end up putting the seat all the way back on. So I'd encourage you to go and look at some of those in terms of the size of the car. In terms of other SUVs and so on to look at, I mean, things like a Volvo XC60, it's not going to be particularly exciting, but it's good in that sort of $70,000-$80,000 mark. But once you're getting up into the top end there's a whole bunch of stuff that really does impress. Porsche Cayenne, for example, is genuinely impressive, albeit expensive. And as I said, that Mercedes with that tricky suspension system is also worth a look.
All right, Ken, good luck with it. Sue, hello. G'day, Sue. Hi, Sue.
Hello.
Hi, Sue.
I have a problem. I'm looking for a car for my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She's reasonably tall, and she's driving my smallish car at the moment. She would like an SUV, a small one, RAV or something like that. I've got a budget of about $30,000, so I probably have to go second hand, I guess. And I really want as many safety features as I can get on it.
Hmm. What do you reckon, Tobes?
So you're going, well, you can actually get into some of the mid-sized SUVs, the new mid-sized SUVs for around that price. There's things on, for example, Ford Escape is doing deals just under $30,000 at the moment. All of those mid-sized SUVs these days have not only the passive safety features, the airbags and so on to protect you if you do have a crash, but they all now come with the autonomous emergency braking. Most of them come with blind spot warning. So you've got a lot of this active technology to try and, avoid the crash in the first place. In terms of the picks in that market, so probably the three odd cars that are at the top of that market, you mentioned the Toyota RAV4. That's definitely towards the top, probably if not the top at the moment. But you're not going to get into one for $30,000. You're going to be, if you can stretch it $3,000 or $4,000, possibly $5,000, you'll start to get into one, and you get a really nice car for that. Subaru Forester is also worth a look, but again, they're not doing big discounts at the moment, and they will. They're even probably another couple of grand on top of that. And Mazda CX-5 is another one that's also worth looking at. CX-5 is worth a look. So assuming you can't stretch to that mid $30,000 mark, if you're in that second-hand market, I probably wouldn't bother with RAV4 because the current one's only been out for, I'm guessing, 7 or 8 months, something like that. So there's not going to be a whole lot on the market. You might get a dealer demo, but it's a little bit tough, but it'll be worth having a chat to a dealer, but I wouldn't hold your breath on it. That said, in the current environment, you never know. So have a look around there, and I would not bother with the previous RAV4. It was a fairly unimpressive car. Not all models had all that safety gear, so it wasn't anywhere near the standard that the current one's at. So in that case, stick to things like a Forester, CX-5. You'll get into one of those secondhand, absolutely, for that sort of money. And as I said, something like that Ford Escape for the money that they're doing, that's, I think it's about 28 grand they're doing them for at the moment, and that's also very good buying at the moment as well. So that's worth a look too.
Okay, great.
There you go, Sue. Good on you.
Thank you very much.
That's all right. Welcome. Peter, hello. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
G'day, Pete.
How are you?
Not bad.
Look, my question is, I'm currently driving a Mitsubishi Triton MQ, and I'm looking at changing over to an LDV T60. I'm hearing some bad reports about the condition of the body after a few years with rust.
Okay, I haven't heard much about that other than obviously one of the things that all the dual cab utes, most of which are built in Thailand these days, so the Ford Ranger and Hilux and so on all come out of Thailand. And from a toughness and build quality perspective, they all have an extremely good reputation. There's plenty of people that bash them around and seem to come up all right. I haven't heard a whole lot, as I said, about issues with LDVs. I haven't driven many of the T60s. I drove one a while ago, a couple of years ago, but haven't driven one in recent years. The one thing I'd be a little bit cautious of, and people got a little bit burnt with this with the Great Wall Utes that came out 2007, 8, 9, around then, was issues with resale value when they went to sell them. So, yes, they could get into one cheaper to start with, and it was obviously a tempting price, and they said, well, that's great, it's $5,000 or $10,000 less than the competitors. But most of them that I'd spoken to ended up losing that on the way out. They found them a little bit tough to sell at the end of it. So once you're up against things like Rangers and Hiluxes and so on, you tend to find that there's obviously some excellent resale going on there, and people can own them for a few years and still have plenty of money invested in them when they go to sell them. So keep that in mind. I'm sorry, as I said, I'll do some looking into what sort of issues can pop up with those things down the track, but I just don't have it at hand with me at the moment.
Okay, thanks, Pete. Goldie, hello. G'day, Goldie.
G'day, mate. How you going?
Not bad.
Hey, I was looking at a Toyota Land Cruiser V8 dual cab or a Dodge Ram 1500. Mm-hmm. Does the Dodge Ram 1500 come in diesel?
It does. So the diesel version of the Ram came out late last year. So it's now part of the lineup. So it's around. I'm trying to think. The price on it is more expensive than the regular one. So the regular V8, you start at a little bit over $80,000 for the base model. To get into the diesel, they only do it in the upper spec one, what they call Laramie, and it starts at about $115,000-$120,000. So to get into that diesel one is a fair step up from the V8, and I guess you start looking at how much you're going to spend on petrol. I guess there's $20,000-odd, $25,000 more there in terms of the initial outlay. So that's something to look at. I guess the advantages are...
What's the V8 Toyota like? Has it got a good reputation, though?
Oh, yeah, amazing reputation. So it's that 4.5 litre. It's the same... The 4.5 litre turbo diesel is the same engine that is in the... Same basic engine that is in the 200 series Land Cruisers, so the wagon, more luxurious version. But it gets a single turbo, whereas in the bigger luxury one, it's a twin turbo engine. So it hasn't got the smoothness or the outright grunt of that car, but it's in terms of a reputation for going on and for towing pretty strongly, it does a good job. Keep in mind, though, that those Land Cruisers, the 70 series Land Cruiser, as they call it, is only a manual. They don't do an automatic transmission in it. So that obviously turns a lot of people off straight away. That said, the farmers love them, the mining companies love them. There's a massive secondhand market for them, as well as obviously new people. And you go out into the country, and that's almost like the Ferrari for the country kids. They love those things. They absolutely stick it on their shopping list and love them. So yeah, they're solid trucks and do a good job.
Mm. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
On your Goldie. Bye bye. Greg, on American trucks. G'day, Greg.
Yeah, Phil. Toby. Toby, just wanting to know what your thoughts are on the Chev Silverado 2500 in relation to towing and more so the DPF system on them.
So the DPF, the diesel particulate filter, I'm not up on any issues specific to that one other than the broad issues with DPF across all modern diesel engines, which is that short trips can obviously clog them up. And every mechanic I've spoken to says that once they end up clogged up and if they fail, they can cost many, many thousands of dollars to replace. But they've all got warning lights on the dash to alert you to obviously when there's an issue with that. But as I said, I'm not aware of any specific issues with the Chevy Silverado. In terms of Silverado 1500, it's actually... 2500, sorry. It's actually converted to right-hand drive by the same people that do the Rams that we've just been chatting about. So they're all done in Melbourne, and they, as with the Ram, there's a significant price premium on them because they arrive in the country with the steering wheel on the left and the conversion is a very thorough conversion. It's a very high quality conversion, but you pay for it. So that's why those 2500 start at sort of $125,000, $130,000 plus. So they're a lot of money. But look, in terms of towing, I haven't towed with one. I've driven one and done plenty of driving in it, and they feel like they're going to tow just about anything. They've got they're obviously an enormous vehicle, and with enormous grunts. So yeah, huge amount of pull, and that big 6.6 litre turbo diesel V8 is a pretty mighty machine. So yeah,
you could pull a few.
Just looking at it for towing and towards touring and towing the caravan.
So a good thing with that regard, keep in mind that with the 2500 Silverados, they actually sell them. So with some of them, they sell them with a different vehicle certification plate depending on what license you want to drive them on. So for the towing, not as much of an issue for the towing, but if you want to load them, if you want to drive it on a regular car license, they're actually only will only carry, it's something like 800 or 900 kilograms. It's not much, like your average Hilux and so on out does it. Whereas they can physically carry more than that, but then to have that certification on the vehicle, you then need to have a different license to actually drive them. So so worth keeping that in mind as well. But as I said, in terms of towing, that the engine is a mighty engine. It's certainly got a heap of torque. I think it's over 1,000 Newton metres from memory, and it's a massive amount of grunt the way it gets going. I mean, it moves the truck on its own very smartly, and you can't imagine another few tonnes out the back slowing it down too much.
Yes, you'd imagine so. All right, Greg, thank you, mate. A few on the text line here, Toby. I'm just about to teach my daughter to drive. We've got an automatic and a manual. Which one do you think would be best, given that she'll be based in Europe in 2021?
Yeah, well, look, Europe is very much switching over to automatics. Yeah. They were very much a manual market, but that said, there are still plenty of manuals in Europe. So whereas Australia, our market, our new car market these days is around 92 or 3% automatics. Europe, I don't know the exact figures, and it would depend where you are in Europe, but I would imagine there'd be somewhere around 60 or 70, something like that. So yes, it's tending towards autos, but you can still, it's still very common to hire a manual, for example, and to see people driving them. So it would be handy in Europe to absolutely have that that manual license. And I still think there are some benefits to teaching younger people to drive with a manual, to get them to understand a bit more about what's going on in the engine and so on. And look, let's face it, that's a complex thing when you're first getting going with the driving and getting used to the clutch and so on. But once you're driving, it's a pretty small component of it. Once you start learning the finer points of mixing with traffic and so on. I would push for the manual, to be honest, to give a bit more breadth and a few more options.
Yeah, exactly. I think you learn. I don't know. I taught both my daughters to drive on manuals. I don't know. I just have a feeling that if you learn it, it makes you concentrate more on the car, you know. And concentrating more on the car means, I think, if you're learning to drive, that's not bad.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I think there's big benefits to it. And look, it's, you know, it might even be as simple as down the track when you want to buy a second-hand car, you tend to be able to pick up manuals these days a lot cheaper than automatics, because so many of the young kids just will not drive a manual. They don't have the license to drive a manual.
And they never learn to drive on them, yeah.
No, that's right. So you look at the used car market, and often, you know, not so much with sports cars and so on, but with the your regular hatchbacks and around town runabouts, the manuals can often be a hell of a lot cheaper than the automatics.
Yeah, yes, I think I'll be driving my diesel manual into the ground, actually. So that's right. Won't have much resale, I wouldn't have thought. Luke, g'day.
Yeah, g'day, Phil, Toby. Yeah, I've got a Ford Ranger. It's a 2019 3.2. I'm just wondering, is it worth putting a catch can on one of those engines? I've just heard, you know, with all the DPF problems, and they get a bit of engine soot and a lot of things running through the engine. Yeah, I've seen a few people get a bit of mess coming out of them.
I've heard
been in warranty too, you know, like, do you know what I mean? So, yeah.
Yeah, I'd be a bit cautious about modifying things like that. I know what you're saying, and I have spoken to people who are working the engines harder in terms of, I guess, catching some of the gunk that forms and saying get that out of the system. But at the same time, the car's under warranty. I wouldn't have a major issue, to be honest. If you're getting it serviced regularly, and driving it semi-normally, I wouldn't have a major issue with trying to add things like that for that. If it was an older car and you were maybe towing 3 tonnes constantly, then possibly. But, yeah, I'd be a little bit cautious. So I think the manufacturers have designed them to do the job, and I if you get it serviced, I'd be fine with that, I think.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, yeah, because obviously, like, we don't tow anything really big. We just go out to the bush and a bit of four wheel driving here and there. So, yeah, that's what I thought. With the warranty, it's probably really not that worth it, really.
Wouldn't buy that. And you've got a five-year warranty on it, and you've also got Australian consumer law that'll probably extend a fraction beyond that anyway. So it wouldn't have a big issue.
No worries, Luke. Thanks, mate. Oh, by the way, David called in, Toby, to remind us that, remember, like 2 weeks ago when you were in last, we had a question right at the end of the program. We didn't have time to talk about it. Which was, can you explain hybrids for us? Because there's more than one type of hybrid, and you were going to explain about the different electric motors. Can you just go and give us a 101 about hybrids?
Yeah, so we'll run into it. So there's, I guess, a few different types of them, as you say. The ones that I guess we've got to know most are the ones that Toyota does, and they're your pretty much garden variety hybrids that Toyota, over the last probably 12 months, has been marketing as self-charging hybrids, which is a nice way of saying they run purely on petrol because you can't charge them at all. They don't have a plug and they can't be recharged in a regular power point. So that's your typical hybrid. In most Toyotas, it pretty much halves fuel use. So this is
essentially an electric motor that drives the wheels. The petrol engine can also drive the wheels, but it also charges the battery. Is that it?
Absolutely, yeah. So, and the other advantage you've got, and where the real fuel savings come in, is when you're braking the car, it effectively reverses the flow of the electric motor and sends some of that electrical energy back into the battery so that when you take off again, that's, I guess, where they're getting at with the self-charging thing. So that's your main hybrid. That's the one we've grown up with and got to know over the last 20-odd years. There's also, in more recent years, we're starting to see these mild hybrids, which pretty much drive like a regular car. Mm-hmm. Most people won't notice the electric motor doing anything because it's a very small electric motor and a very small battery. So it's all about reducing fuel use by usually around 5 or 10%, something like that. But for all intents and purposes, they drive pretty much like a regular petrol or diesel-powered car. And the third one is plug-in hybrid vehicles. So these are becoming more and more common, particularly in Europe, where a lot of the cities in Europe these days have requirements where you are not allowed to produce any emissions at all in the CBD. So they get around that by running them purely on electricity. And most of these plug-in hybrids, the main difference with a plug-in hybrid, it has a bigger battery. So it's the same, basically the same system, but they'll have a bigger battery in there so that you can run them typically for 30 kilometres plus on electricity only. Once you get beyond that 30, 40, 50 kilometres, the engine kicks in as well and helps recharge the battery, but can also be used to power the car. So most European brands these days have a plug-in hybrid all the way down from, from your Volkswagens and Audis and so on up to Porsches. Ferrari is doing one shortly. They're doing their first plug-in hybrid. They've done a regular hybrid. They haven't done a plug-in hybrid, but they are doing one very soon called the SF90. So they're all heading down that path. So that those plug-in hybrids, as I said, are becoming more and more common. The challenge with those plug-in hybrids is the cost. So they tend to be more expensive because you've got the batteries, and the batteries are the expensive part of an electric car. And they're also a little bit compromised in terms of you're carrying around. So when you're driving it purely in electricity, you're dragging around a fuel tank, an engine, a gearbox and everything else that's not getting used. So there's a lot of extra weight there that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So they are a compromised solution, but they tick the box in terms of reducing fuel use, and with those plug-in hybrids, often eliminating fuel use altogether.
Mm. Yes, all right, that's it. Okay, Dennis wants you to explain a few other terminologies too. Hello, Dennis.
Hey, g'day, mate. Look, you use these little codes of CRV, et cetera, et cetera. Just wondering if you could explain what they stand for.
Oh, CVT, is that what you're thinking about?
Or the Honda CRV?
The CRV, that's just the model name.
It's just the name of the model, yeah.
Yeah, just the model of the car. But what you might be thinking about, I often mention CVT transmissions, which stands for continuously variable transmission. So the difference with those is instead of having a regular, a normal transmission typically has between, say, 5 and 10 gears to choose from, a CVT has an infinite number of ratios available. So it basically adjusts to what you're asking from it and the speed you're doing, whether you're going up and down a hill and so on. So it almost in some cases feels a bit like a slipping clutch in terms of you don't get any gear changes at all. It just starts taking off and you get this engine sort of revving nice and cleanly, and then it just adjusts the revving depending on what you're doing with your right foot. So those CVTs, well, they're often used for performance but also for fuel economy as well. So a lot of the European makers and indeed these days the Japanese brands, so Toyota and Honda and so on, all use those CVTs as well. And they've been a fairly popular solution for, as I said, improving efficiency generally.
Mm. Okay, thanks, Dennis. 1-300-800-222. Julie, hello. Hello, Julie.
Oh, hello, Philip. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I was just wanting to ask Toby, I heard the lady ringing up before just asking about a car for her daughter, and you, Toby, recommended the Mazda CX-5, which I actually drive, and it is a great car, or Subaru Forester, or was it, and the RAV4, am I right in saying that was the one?
Yeah, that's it.
My 27-year-old daughter is just looking to buy her first new car. She's just sort of had second-hand ones, and she's currently really keen on the Mitsubishi ASX. I think it's a GSR model,
yep.
I think.
Yeah, that's right.
And so because you didn't sort of mention that in the group of SUVs, I just was really wanting to get your opinion about that.
So ASX, the biggest appeal with the ASX is value. So that car is, I'm guessing here, it's roughly 7 or 8 years old. And they, without joking, would have done probably 5, possibly 6 updates to it over the years. So they sort of throw a new bumper and a new grill at it and just freshen it up a little bit. But really they focus on price heavily with that car. So it's okay. Yep. It's good value. It's not one of the standout cars in that segment. It's just a reasonable car. It's also smaller than those other cars I was talking about. So those three I was chatting about before are... Are certainly a size up on this one. So in terms of rear seat space and so on, and boot space, they've got more boot space. So that's the main thing. But look, in that sort of smaller SUV category, the ASX is, as I said, value buying. I wouldn't say it's the best car in that segment. The one I'd actually direct you to that I think is a pretty nice all rounder in that segment, and also ticks the value box, is the Kia Seltos, which is it's only been out about 3 or 4 months, and that's really good buying. It's I think it feels fresher. It's certainly nicer to drive than the Mitsubishi. If you can stretch to the turbo engine, which is a little bit more, it's in the $30,000 mark, then that's good buying as well. The 2-litre, the regular 2-litre engine is a reasonable one as well. But that's worth a look. Okay. And the new Mazda CX-30 is the new is the one closer on size to that ASX that's worth
it
a look as well.
So a little bit more expensive when we sort of looked at that, and she liked the... And also I think at the moment it had a 7-year warranty and two-year free servicing and 1-year cap servicing, I think. And so that's sort of what was leaning.
Yeah, absolutely. So
as well.
I absolutely wouldn't say don't look at it. I'd just say, as I said, I would definitely go and look at a Kia dealership. You'll also get the 7-year warranty on those. Worth a look there as well. Uh-huh.
Oh, thanks. Thanks
Julie.
So much for all of that. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Cool. Pleasure. Bye. Thanks, Julie. Bye-bye. 1-300-800-222. Edwin, sorry, you've been waiting on there, Edwin.
Yeah. Hi there. My question is, I wanted to know more about these 5 and 7 year warranties. I'm looking to buy a Seltos or a Kona, and I'm wondering, I know that they won't cover tyres and batteries, but 7 years is a long time to give you a warranty. And I'm wondering if there's anything I should look out for with these type of warranties.
No, so the factory, the warranties that you've really got to look out for are typically the extended warranties offered by a dealership. So they often have a lot of exceptions in terms of what they will cover, and they also have some exception or some requirements in terms of service requirements, often requiring you to service them at that exact dealership where you bought the extended warranty. So I'd be cautious of those. The warranties you're talking about, which are the factory warranties that come with the car, the 5 and the 7 year respectively for Hyundai and Kia, they will cover, as you say, they don't cover consumables, tyres, brakes and so on. but they're going to cover pretty much everything else. So it's so they again, they have some exceptions for things like people using them for commercial use, so particularly Uber drivers and so on. They'll say they put a kilometre limit on it. I think it's 150,000 or something around there, but again, check the website for that. But no, there's not a whole lot that they skip out. They're all they're rigidige, and they'll certainly cover you and give you that peace of mind up until the 7 years in the case of Kia.
Yeah, Edwin, I'll just adding, I think that's the feedback we've had from a lot of listeners too, that generally these things are on it.
Yeah. The other question is, I'm looking at a Seltos or a Kona, and I'm wondering Seltos. What do you think of those two in comparison, please?
So the Seltos, is a big step up. There are similarities with them in terms of some of the componentry they use underneath. But the biggest issue with the Kona is the engine. The engine, you've sort of got to work it pretty hard. You end up having to thrash it a bit to keep it moving, whereas the Seltos has a little bit more grunt. The Seltos is also fractionally bigger as well. So it feels like, to me, getting into the Kona felt like they'd built it a bit to a price, whereas getting into the Seltos felt it was a proper sort of car for what it was. So,
there you go.
So, yeah, Seltos.
Straightforward answer there. All right, thanks, Edwin. Paul, hello. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Phil and Toby, I've got a Ford XR5 2007 model Focus.
Mm-hmm.
I am waiting with bated breath for them to release the Ford Focus RS, which I believe is going to be a turbocharged hybrid.
Yeah, that's right. There's talk of having a pretty tricky hybrid system in it where they run the electric motors on the rear wheels, or an electric motor on the rear wheel, and the engine, a 2-litre four-cylinder turbo powering the front wheels. And I think they're talking up around about 300 kilowatts or something for that car. So that's certainly the reports I've been looking at out of Europe, and they're obviously working towards that. We don't know more other than that, that it is, it's obviously a little bit of a way off, but the guys in the know in Europe tend to think it'll be around that. So, look, the challenge, obviously, with that sort of setup is making sure it's affordable. But with a brand like Ford, I mean, the previous one was, mid-$60,000 mark, something like that, for the RS. And I would imagine they'd be targeting that sort of figure again to try and make sure they can get it in there. There's also some advantages with doing a system like that. So, yes, they're spending more money on things like electric motors and batteries, but they're missing out things like a four-wheel drive system. All of a sudden, they can delete that that drive shaft that goes from front to rear and save a bit of weight there, but also save a bit of money. So it's I think everyone's waiting to see whether that sort of thing comes to fruition. And I tend to think that's the way a lot of these performance brands are going to go in future, because they're having to do these sorts of things to meet the emissions regulations in Europe. They're finding it's cheaper to do that sort of thing than to lightweight the car and so on everywhere else. But also because they can get performance benefits out of it, and obviously try some new technology and get some marketing spin from that perspective.
Mm, okay, all right. Thanks, thanks, Paul. Vincent, a question about a Suzuki. Vincent, hi.
Hi. Good evening, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Look, I'm just want to inquire. Would you recommend a Suzuki Vitara for a secondary car for a family of three young children?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the, all those cars we've just been talking about, like the Seltos and so on, also worth a look. But I'm a fan of the Vitara, particularly if you can stretch to the turbo engine, the little 1.4 turbo. It's quite a sweet engine and suits the car really nicely. But yes, definitely. In terms of they've now ticked the boxes with the safety features. It has a really nice clear screen, infotainment screen in the center with Apple CarPlay and so on embedded in it. So it's plenty of equipment for the money and value. And look, Suzuki's have a reputation for longevity and reliability. So it's a nice little car for what it is. Probably pretty underrated in that that sort of small to mid-size SUV segment. But as I said, good buying. So yeah, go for it.
Go for it, Vincent.
And is it true the turbo needs to be run on nothing less than 95?
I'd have to check that. Not sure on that off the top of my head, but all those cars these days, they've all got NOx sensors so that they can adjust according to the fuel that you're putting in there. That said, the modern cars that are coming out with these gasoline particulate filters or petrol particulate filters, either PPF or GPF, depending on who you're talking to. So we're starting to see cars coming out with that now, more so at the top end of the market. But in the next few years, we're going to see more of those petrol particulate filters come out. And when you have those, they have a real issue with the amount of sulphur in the fuel. And in Australian fuel, the regular unleaded, I think it goes up to 150 parts per million of sulphur, whereas the premium unleaded is limited to, I think it's 50 parts per million, something like that. But effectively, the premium unleaded is much cleaner fuel in terms of how much sulphur it has. So I don't think it'd be an issue with a Vitara. But with anyone else buying these newer vehicles, you have to be extremely careful about not putting the low-grade regular petrol in there.
Okay. What is the story with that, though, Toby? I mean, most of our fuel comes out of Singapore anyway, doesn't it? I mean, it's not, we don't refine it here in Australia. We've got very limited refining.
We've got
capacity.
Limited, but we do still refine it here. And the refineries say to change over and be able to refine to the levels that the rest of the world has. And we have extremely low-grade petrol here in Australia. The diesel's actually quite high quality.
Yeah, but I suppose that's why I'm asking him, because, I mean, is this stuff that's refined in Singapore for Australia?
No. So a lot of the premium unleaded is refined overseas and imported, is
right.
My understanding.
Right.
But a lot of the regular unleaded is refined in Australia, and the oil companies or the fuel suppliers here say that to upgrade the refineries would cost them how many bazillion dollars.
Okay.
And they say as a result, that'll make petrol more expensive. So there's a big barney going on now between the car makers and the fuel suppliers. Car makers are saying, we want to bring these cars in, but we can't run them on that grade of fuel. And they're saying, why don't you just import it or import more of it from overseas and get the proper grade stuff? So, as I said, it's a bit of a battle going on at the moment.
Yeah. A couple of texts saying, what's happening at the Holden clearance sale?
So I visited a few dealers over the last couple of weeks to get a feel for it. Some of the dealers are saying that they are down to very low stock, so they reckon they could be run out in a few weeks.
Oh, okay.
Other dealers are saying more like June. But keep in mind, I said I spoke to them a week or two ago, so that might stretch out given what's happening with the industry and the turmoil we're seeing everywhere. So that could stretch out a little bit. But look, the Holden dealers, they were all fighting for some models in particular. Colorados, for example, they found the Utes very easy to sell, so they were battling over those. And every dealer I spoke to said there's no trading going on between dealers. So if someone comes in and says, have you got a Colorado, if they don't have one sitting there, they're not going to go, the other dealer's not going to give it to them. Whereas that often happens with dealers. They'll often do the trading behind the scenes, but they're saying they don't want to do that because they reckon they can sell them all pretty easily. So in terms of the discounts, there are some pretty sharp discounts there, but they're not what was initially talked of. You're not talking of saving $15,000 or $20,000. In some cases, you might save $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 over what they were selling them for 3 or 4 months ago. And, you know, that tends to be the rough sort of savings you're getting there. So, but you've got to keep in mind that any of those Holdens you buy now, from a resale value perspective, that brand doesn't exist as of later this year. So they're going to be worth less down the track potentially. So you'd want to factor that into what you're buying. Not so much of an issue if you're going to hold on to the car for 6, 7, 8 years, not an issue. But if you want to sell it in a couple of years, I'd absolutely keep that in the back of your mind.
Yeah, it is an important point, isn't it? That's right. Mm-hmm. Which goes to a lot of these things, whether it's Great Walls or anything else. You know, if you get in cheaply, you're likely to be forced to get out cheaply too.
Absolutely. And look, resale value in a car is crucial. It's not crucial with a fridge or anything else like that, because you run it to the ground and buy a new one. But with a car, the vast majority of people want to have it worth something after a few years. And it can make, in some cases, tens of thousands of dollars difference, depending on what you get. So it's a massive difference.
All right. Well, all that went pretty smoothly. I think we might get one of these models. Toby, sorry about the interruption earlier, but that's the perils of technology. But thanks for your time. We'll talk again in a couple of weeks. Good on you.
Sounds great. Thanks, Phil.
Terrific. Toby Hagen with Motor Talk. And Toby, as I say, will be back with us in a couple of weeks.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.